Newsom. Salama, thank you, and welcome to Juno Afternoon. I'm Boston Christopher. Today, Taku Winds, the wind ensemble from Juno Community Bands, is having a concert, Rhapsody in Blue, this Saturday night, March 7th. We chat with conductor Alan Young and president of the board, Sarah McNair Grove, about the program. The library is presenting a conversation with two authors this Sunday called Touchstones of Glaciers and Bears, Navigating a Changing Climate. We'll have a preview. And Mudrooms wraps up its storytelling season next Tuesday with the theme, Rut-Row, Doggone It. We'll find out all about it. Those conversations coming up this hour on Juno Afternoon from your community-supported public media station, KTOO. You can also catch our live stream on KTOO's YouTube, Facebook, and Instagram pages. Support for Juno Afternoon comes from Emil Mackey at Country Financial, offering insurance for home, auto, and business, and life insurance to protect your family in case of death. Located in the Juno Nugget Mall. More information can be found online or by calling 907-500-7017. You are listening to community-supported Juno Afternoon on KTOO 104.3 Juno, 91.7 Juno Auk Bay, and online at ktoo.org. I'm Boston Christopher. This Saturday, Taku Winds, the Adult Winds Ensemble from Juno Community Bands, presents Gershwin, Rhapsody in Blue. It's March 7th. 2026. It's at 7 p.m. It's at Thunder Mountain Middle School. It's conducted by Alan Young. It's going to be featuring Kyle Farley Robinson on piano And I'm joined now in the studio by conductor Alan Young and president of the board, Sarah McNair-Grove. Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to have you both here. Wasiati, how are you today, Alan?
Doing well, thank you. Thanks for having me.
Excellent. Welcome back. And of course, Sarah, Wasiati to you. Welcome back. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks for having us.
Of course, yeah. So let's talk a little bit about this in reviewing the program and listening to some of this music. It's some of the most recognizable music. So how did we get to putting this program together, Alan?
So I was asked by the board to if I wanted to conduct the concert. Of course, I said yes, because I love working with this group. And at that time, they had already kind of figured out we wanted to work with Kyle Farley Robinson as a soloist, and that piece was what we wanted to perform. And so I kind of came into programming knowing that was going to be the feature, and got to build a program around that piece, which was a unique opportunity and a lot of fun.
I love that. And Sarah, remind us about the Taku Winds Ensemble. It's one feature of the Juno Community Bands. Break that down for us.
Yeah, the Juno Community Bands has several different groups to try to appeal to different people and different levels of experience so that people don't come in and be frustrated or bored. And Taku Winds is for our more experienced wind and percussion players. And we also are the ones that sponsor the Juno 4th of July marching band. So you'll see us in the parades, and that's open to everybody, anybody 7th grade and older. And we also have a little reindeer band that we play Christmas music around town. So you might see us like at the museum on First Friday or Gallery Walk, and we play at Wildflower Court or the Pioneer Home and take a little music around town. So.
Now, do people who play in sort of the larger ensemble pieces that you do, you see some of them graduating to the adult Taku Winds Ensemble at some point?
Actually,
does that happen?
Yes, we do. For the last couple of summers, we've had quite a few high school students play in our sit-down concerts for the 4th of July, and several of them have played in the Taku Winds with us. So, yeah, we do encourage good high school players to play us when they can.
I love that. And so this program, is this the main spring concert for Taku Winds?
Yes, it is. We usually do two concerts a year, one in the fall and one in the spring. And for the last several years, we've been trying to feature a soloist. Usually it's been one of the members of Taku Winds who has been our soloist. And I think about 2 years ago, Kyle actually approached us and said he would really love to play Rhapsody in Blue. Could we, you know, find a spot for him? And we said, oh, we'd be delighted to do that. So this has been the works for about 2 years.
Wow. Yeah. Okay. And the other part of this program, Alan, that we put together, so the main thing was to have Rhapsody in Blue be the feature, and I think that closes out the concert. But
yes.
Then you had to select things that were complementary, or how did you go about figuring out what else you would play? This is a pretty full program, yeah?
Yeah. So it was a lot of fun to put the program together, because you can take that a lot of you can take one piece and the style and take it a lot of different directions. And kind of what I cued in on, which I've just been having a real joy putting it to, rehearsing it with it, is if you look at most of the music on the program, it's other works for piano that have been transcribed for an entire full concert band. So
that's the case
with the other Gershwin piece, the prelude that we're playing to open the concert. We have Scott Joplin, who's famous for writing ragtime solo piano music, and we have a transcription of his Maple Leaf Rag. We also have Charles Ives, the Alcotts, which is just a fantastic, beautiful solo piece for piano, and it's an incredible arrangement. I love these transcriptions for band from the solo piano, because you have all of the intricacies of the original instrument, but then all these new tone colors from the different instruments that are playing it in the band. So it's a really fun thing to put together.
And you also have in here scenes from the Louvre, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's a couple of different pieces. Buffalo Jump Ritual. That sounds fun. What's that?
Yeah, so stylistically, that one's a little bit of a standout. But because the other thing that happened to come out of that of my theme is that they all are also American composers.
Mm.
And so Dan Buckfitch is the composer of that piece. He teaches at the university level in Idaho, and he's also a very good composer.
Mm.
He's a percussionist and himself, and he always does really cool and interesting things with the rhythm of the pieces of music, and they usually maybe not advertise as percussion features, but they certainly have a lot of percussion depth to them. And sometimes he just treats the entire band like a big percussion instrument, which is really cool.
Mm.
But Buffalo Jump Ritual, it's a more or less a tone poem about how the Native American buffalo jumps in the Midwest.
Mm-hmm. That sounds awesome. And then I think the program rounds out with Country Gardens by Percy Aldridge Granger. So that's a really nice full program. Now, jumping back to you real quick, Sarah. So this is just one night.
Just one night, yep.
One possibly snowy night.
And everybody needs to come out and, blow away the snowy blues and get some Rhapsody in
blue.
That's
right, yeah. get this good-feeling music in your body, for sure. Yeah. So it's one night, Saturday night, 7 p.m. And, of course, you can always go to jhc.org for tickets or go to junocommunityband.org for more information and the list of this full program. What I'm curious about, Alan, is how do you find, as a composer or a conductor, how do you find the different translations? Are these just available out there? Do you do research on the interwebs? Do you have other conductors that you talk with and say, hey, I'm kind of looking for this kind of piece of music? And they go, oh, I know so-and-so's got this arrangement. How does it work?
Yeah, it's a lot of fun because it kind of ends up being like a little bit of a treasure hunt,
mm-hmm.
especially if you have a piece that you know you'd like to do, and then that's the starting point. You have to try to find an appropriate arrangement from there. It can be a fun, mostly fun rabbit hole to go down.
Yeah.
One of my favorite ways to go about that is talking with my colleagues, who are either other conductors or professors of music in other universities around the States. And I'm very thankful to have a pretty good network with them and have good relationships. And we, just share a lot of music together over text or email. And, it's like, hey, have you heard this recording of this piece? Or there, so-and-so just came out with a new transcription of this. It's really good. And then a good standby and old faithful, so to speak, is a lot of the music that was written for the military bands.
Mm.
So some of the premier military bands, such as the President's Own Marine Band, is such a wealth of a resource in terms of they always have commissions going on for new works or transcriptions of works for the medium of concert band.
I see. Okay, that's really cool. And how many people are in the Taku Winds ensemble?
We have about 40 players this time. It varies from 25 to we've had 45 or 50, but I think it's about 40 this time.
And what are the instruments that make up the Winds ensemble?
Well, you've got your flutes and clarinets and oboes and saxophones and bassoons, and those are most of the woodwinds, I guess. And then the brass is tubas and trombones and baritones and trumpets and French horns.
Wow. So it is interesting because, like, say something like your grounded piece here, the Rhapsody in Blue, that can be played with giant orchestras or in smaller you know, ensembles, and then sort of like, I guess I would figure this is like, is this what you consider like a medium ensemble?
Yeah, you've mentioned Rhapsody in Blue. I think what's interesting about the arrangement that we're playing, most people hear it in an orchestra setting.
Yeah.
Its original performance, premiere performance, was Gershwin playing the piano with a jazz band. It was not orchestral. And so the arrangement we're playing is very close to the original jazz band arrangement.
Oh, that's kind of
fun. So I think that's kind of fun.
Yeah, that is cool. Because a lot of times you hear, yeah, full orchestra. I like seeing these smaller, I mean, 40's a lot, but I mean, in terms of these smaller ideas, and because it seems like to get some of the, like, the highs and lows and the ins and outs and all the cool different melodies in there with different instruments, it can really bring a different kind of sound to the music. Am I on the right course there, Alan?
Oh, yeah, totally. You know, I have done a lot of work with string orchestras, and I absolutely love them. But something that is so unique to, like, the concert band or the wind ensemble with the grouping of instruments is that every pair of different instruments interacts with each other in a different way tonally, and it creates this just new mix, this wonderful blend of tonal colors that you can create that isn't really possible with a more homogeneous ensemble like a string orchestra.
Mm-hmm.
So it's will always have a really big piece of my heart is that wind ensemble music because of those tonal possibilities.
And this is you've been on the show since I've been here doing Juno Afternoon for a few times, and as your conducting career continues to grow, what else is coming up for you after this concert?
Well, after this concert, I look forward to continuing working with Taku Winds. Other than that, honestly, I've one of the things that I've had a really amazing time with is having more opportunities just to play as an instrumentalist in some groups around town. So playing music with friends is...
Love that.
I absolutely love it.
Well, it's great to have great conductors right here.
We
in
really
town,
are
yeah.
fortunate to yeah. have people like Alan yeah. and before him we have had Todd.
Yeah.
Right here in our own community with the wealth of talent, it's just great.
Yeah, Juno never ceases to amaze me in that way. And what's coming up for Juno community bands after this concert? I know you have some stuff coming down the line.
We have some very exciting things coming up. In the middle of April, we are holding a high school concerto competition, and the winner of that competition will play their solo with the 4th of July marching band concert, and we're also going to give them a $500 scholarship to further their music education in some way.
So
competition is going to be open to the public at no charge. So if you want to come and hear some great high school players, you're certainly welcome to do that.
I love that. Okay, cool. And of course, you can go to junocommunityband.org for more information about all the upcoming events. See the full program for this event, Rhapsody in Blue, which is Saturday night at Thunder Mountain Middle School. It starts at 7 p.m. Buck the snow and go to the concert. And you can also find information and tickets at the jahc.org, the Jack Ticketing website. Alan Young and Sarah, thank you so much for coming in and sharing with us about this event.
Thank you for having us come to the concert.
We're going to go out with a little bit of that Maple Leaf Rag from Scott Joplin, because that is a tune that will get you dancing. Right? It's pretty familiar to everybody, too. This is Juno Afternoon on KTOO.
Support for Juno Afternoon comes from Heritage Coffee Roasting Company, providing Juno with locally roasted coffee for over 40 years, with cafes and drive-through locations throughout Juno. More at heritagecoffee.com.
This is Juno Afternoon from your listener-supported public media station, KTOO. I'm your host, Boston Christopher. Writers Naomi Clauda and Mary Beth Holloman will present a slideshow, Touchstones of Glaciers and Bears, Navigating a Changing Climate. Clauda is the author of the Alaska Glacier Dictionary, and Holloman wrote the newly released Bloom Again. I also want to mention that I think Naomi has something coming out this summer as well. There was a preview on your website, I believe. They will discuss Juneau region glaciers and writing about a climate change. The talk is this Sunday, March 8th at 1 p.m. at the Valley Library. You can head over to juno.org/library for the full calendar that the Juno Library has of all their upcoming events. But I welcome to the studio now Naomi and Mary Beth. Gunath Cheesh, ha, Gunath Cheesh for being here. Wasi Adi, how are you today? How's it going, Mary Beth? Nope, Naomi. Right. Naomi's over here on my left. Sorry about that. How's it going? How are you today?
Real good. Real happy to be here in Juneau.
Yeah, I know you guys just flew in. And then, Mary Beth, how are you today? Wasi Adi.
I'm doing great. Yeah. And thanks so much for having us. This is great.
Awesome. So how you two, did you know each other before this talk was scheduled? So I guess I'm curious, like, how did this talk come about?
Yeah.
Well, first of all, I think that I invited Mary Beth to come and do a talk with me. She had written an essay in the Alaska Glacier Dictionary, and we've been friends and cohorts for quite a long time, since the 1980s.
Oh, okay.
We did an MFA together at the University of Alaska Anchorage under
excellent.
Ron Spatz and Tom Sexton.
Okay.
So we go back a long way together, and our careers have kind of gone parallel a little bit, I think, with heading toward thoughts of climate change and touchstones of animals and nature and places we've been. So it seemed like a natural pairing to invite her to help help do a presentation, a slideshow.
I love that.
And give a nice talk about a nice picture of how we can proceed with climate angst. It's not easy, but there are steps we can probably take to make a visible constructive difference.
Now, you live in Homer.
I do.
And you wrote this book, The Alaska Glacier Dictionary. How did this come about, this book?
Well, I'm a retired journalist now, but during the years that I was a reporter, I would bump into stories about glaciers. Like, for example, if you've been to Homer, or people who have been to Homer would know about all of the glaciers right across the bay from there. And there, you'd be writing about something like Homer Electric Association and their new dam, and all of a sudden there has a glacier connection to it, because Dixon Glacier, its runoff supplies the water that supplies the generation for that dam. So basically, glaciers are doing things out there that's helping us have electricity. And Iklutna Glacier out of Anchorage, you know, that's something that's the drinking water for an entire Alaska's biggest city. So you would bump into those kinds of details as a journalist and go to try to find out more information about those glaciers. How big are they? How much have they been studied? How much are they melting? Are they stable? Where did that name come from? You know, who's the one who decided to name Glacier Dixon? And who was Dixon, for example? Or Gruink? Or Portlock? Or, in your case, Mendenhall here. Who's Taku? Where did that name come from? Mm-hmm. You know, you'd start in with all of these wonderful questions that would lead you into different areas of research, and I would pursue those areas and set aside notes when I was a journalist, thinking somebody ought to write a reference book someday.
How many glaciers are in the book?
700.
What? Mm-hmm. Wow, that's amazing.
Yeah, it took about 10 years putting together my notes and then really going into it all out, like my 16-hour-a-day job for a long time was this dictionary. And I loved doing it. It fed itself. It fed me energy and ideas.
That's amazing. I know recently we had a story, I don't know, it was a couple months ago maybe, one of our climate and weather reporter, Alex Solomon, that the Mendenhall Glacier has receded from the lake. Like it doesn't actually touch the lake anymore, which is very interesting.
Not at all. That is.
Apparently, yeah. So, and I don't know what the future holds for that. Obviously, we also have the Glof, the flooding every year that comes up from that area. And there's just a lot about it that's kind of interesting. So what an interesting topic to tackle. Was this like your retirement project?
It was.
It's so funny, right?
Because it was like.
Yeah.
Yeah, congratulations, you're retired. Now you can do what you want.
Yeah, I remember my grandfather retired, and then he's like, I got to do something. Like, I can't just do nothing, right? Because that was way long ago when you retired, much earlier than we do now, usually. He was pretty retired at the time, but and did all kinds of things to keep himself busy. It was pretty funny. But, I mean, this has just been – I love that you had all the notes for years and then just sort of knew that this was going to be something you would tackle at some point. Yeah, that's amazing. And so, Mary Beth, you have written nonfiction and fiction, right?
And poetry, too.
And poetry as well. Okay. And your latest book, The Bloom Again, this is a really interesting story because I saw something you were talking about, and you said it's like you took like two paths that you could have taken in your life or that might have been.
Yeah.
And then they kind of, you had these characters. And tell me a little bit about your book, Bloom Again.
Yeah, so I had never written fiction before this novel.
Okay.
And I had written about climate change in essays and poetry, but I wanted to do more, but I realized I wasn't even reading nonfiction about climate change anymore. It's so depressing, you know? And so I knew of some other authors that, like Barbara Kingsolver, you know, who takes issues like that, but she puts them into a story with characters. And so then the reader is drawn along with the character. So anyhow, I just started playing around with it, and I thought, you know, a lot of us at a certain point in our lives, we go, what if? You know, like, what if I'd done that instead of that, you know? And so I almost got a degree in botany and started studying plants and devoting my whole life to plants. And so I have a character who studies, she's a professor of paleobotany, so she's studying plant fossils. I'm really deep down that rabbit hole.
Wow.
And the other character is a painter, because that was my other what if, is what if I had gone into visual art? I love visual art, and I so admire people that do it. And so she's an oil painter. So it was fun to start from that point and then just see where the fiction went. Because, of course, it went wherever it went. And this kind of magic happened that I'd heard other novelists talk about, but I was like, oh, yeah, right. You know, I didn't really believe them. But it's true that at some point the two characters took over, and I just felt like I was just transcribing on my computer what they were going to do or say next. I wasn't having to think about it. I was just recording it, and they were just doing it. So
that's so interesting. Very cool. And that came out last fall, right?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. And since you had this experience of writing, I guess that, do they call this like eco fiction or something like that?
You could call it that. Yeah.
I mean, it sort of has that underpin. It's a story, but it's including climate and things inside the story and the narrative. Yeah. So, which I really enjoy because I love stories. And I think you can hook people with stories better than just like facts and numbers, right?
Exactly.
Like because then people can tune out. But then you get hooked into somebody's story and what they're going through. So I'm curious, like now that you've written your first fiction, are you hooked on writing some more fiction? Where are you at with that?
I don't know. I've kind of gone back to poetry.
Oh, you have?
Okay. I think poetry is a really special form because fiction reaches you on different layers because it allows you to get emotionally invested.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what you're saying is like with a science article about climate change, it's just facts. It's just kind of left brain stuff, you know. Mm. And I really feel like we need to have our hearts, we need to allow our emotional responses to help guide us as well, and not just be guided by the rational. And poetry is pretty good at that too.
Yeah, definitely.
But I don't know. I mean, I with the novel, there are a couple characters that I'm kind of curious, like to do a little. There's a son. One of the main characters, Elise, has a son, and I'd be curious to write his story going forward. And then one of the characters, the one in North Carolina, Astrid, her grandmother's story would be really interesting. So that's kind of
we'll see. You create like a whole world of characters in the in that world that you live in, and you write all the different stories. That's kind of really cool. I love
that. Then, so some of the minor characters become they're so interesting. I'd kind of like to dive into them.
And you're from you're out of Anchorage now.
I'm in Anchorage.
Okay, absolutely. Well, it's nice to have you both here in Juneau. And then Naomi, I mentioned a teaser. I think I saw on your website that you have like a little preview of something that you're working on. What's that that you're working on?
Right. It's called The Octopus Murders, and it's a novella.
Okay.
I've been having fun with novellas. They're short. They're longer. They're more satisfying than a short story, but they don't take as long as a novel, I guess, maybe. I don't know what my psychology is, but The Octopus Murders came to me from a situation that we see in Homer where there, we have paintings around or etchings or some kind of art pieces that are made out of octopus ink. So where does that ink come from, and how do they extract that ink from an octopus? And does the octopus die afterwards, or is it truly regenerated? A lot of questions, and so I ended up with a character who was killed because of he was one of the he was the harvester of octopus ink, and he ends up dead. He washed in with the beach shore. Debris, and it, sort of that was the idea. Went from there, you know, what kind of a mystery wouldn't that make an incredible mystery of what happened to this guy? And of course, people will be guessing: did the octopuses do it? Did they seek revenge? But to not get fruity or sci-fi on it, but to really use science and try to figure out what are octopuses capable of.
Have you written fiction before?
Yes, my MFA is in fiction, and I did my collection of short stories, and then I did Anna's Well, which is a novella.
Right. So you bounce back and forth between the nonfiction and the fiction. Because you were also, as a reporter, you were obviously doing nonfiction as well. Yeah, and then the Glacier Dictionary and all that kind of stuff. That's really cool. When's that book going to come out?
It'll be out in April.
April, so soon.
Right.
I love that. Let me give your websites, and then I want to talk about Sunday a little bit more. So you can find Naomi at Naomi Clauda Books, which is Clauda spelled K-L-O-U-D-A. So NaomiClaudaBooks.com. And then you can find Mary Beth Holloman at MaryBethHolloman.com. It's two L's in Holloman, H-O-L-L-E-M-A-N, MaryBethHolloman.com. Do you have a collection of poetry coming out soon, Mary Beth?
Poetry collection came out a couple years ago. It's called Tender Gravity. And then I also have this book that just came out this month.
Oh, yeah.
Alaska Literary Field Guide. I'm one of three editors, along with Nancy Lord, who lives in Homer, and Shailene Grace Moeller, who got her degree here at UAS and is from CAKE, but now she's living in Sitka. But this book is... has a lot of poetry in it.
Oh,
and
nice.
And as poets, like 72 Alaska poets are represented in here, and 20 Alaska artists. Oh, we took 93 different beings, like, brown bear, different kind of fish, plants. And for each being, we have a poem by an Alaska poet, a piece of art by an Alaska artist, and then we wrote little micro essays about each being, too. So science and culture and art and poetry. I love it.
I love the mixture of that. That is so cool.
Right.
Yeah.
Wow. So this Sunday, y'all are doing a presentation, Touchstones of Glaciers and Bears, Navigating a Changing Climate. It's going to be this Sunday at the Valley Library. It starts at 1 p.m. What can we expect on Sunday? What are we going to be talking about?
Well, we do talk about touchstones. Touchstones are a point in your life that you are touched by something and it becomes your touchstone. Like, I would imagine that for many people in Juneau, Mendenhall Glacier is a touchstone because you identify with it, it changes you, you internalize it as sort of part of your identity as a community, that you are people of the glaciers. I mean, you live right next door to a glacier that is very dramatic, and you don't know what's ahead for the years to come. So somehow that glacier might be what's considered a touchstone. An aspect of nature that you go back to, and you kind of, your mind kind of keeps thinking about it when maybe you were thinking about something else. There are different kinds of touchstones to have. For me, a glacier was a touchstone. Matanuska Glacier was my first one, and they say that you'll remember your first glacier like you would your first kiss. There's something about touchstones, and they help you navigate through climate change, I believe, because you're going to be thinking about what can you do to protect, or what can you do to highlight, what can you do to, what is your duty to spread the word about this particular touchstone that might be in trouble. And of course, glaciers are in very big trouble. So that's one aspect of touchstones. I think Mary Beth has some other examples because she's come nose to nose with a polar bear.
Oh, so we're gonna have pictures of these things as well. Is that what we're gonna be?
Yeah, no one snapped the photo of me nose to nose with a polar bear, but
let me get a selfie.
But I do have a close up photo of the polar bear himself. And so that moment became a touchstone for me. That bear became a touchstone for me. Even though I don't live with polar bears, I only got to visit them once. And yet I feel that that's another form of touchstone. It's like you can live around all the time, or you can have that experience once. I imagine people that go, say, to a very, like the Grand Canyon, you know, when they see the Grand Canyon, it's like it burns in their memory so clearly and deeply that it's a reference point for the rest of their lives.
So a
polar bear in particular, but polar bears in general are main characters in this novel. It's also, like I said, one of the characters is from the East Coast, so you know, most populated part of the country in the United States, where they're not really noticing glaciers disappearing or polar bears disappearing, right? Because they don't have them. It's not part of their reality. And so I wanted to have a character whose reality was not our reality, you know. But for her, it's about, she's a plant person, right? And so it's about a plant that becomes endangered because the sea level is rising in eastern North Carolina. It's really low-lying, and what happens when these low-lying meadows are flooded. So anyhow, I wanted to bring in just the fact that our touchstones come based on our experiences and on what we live around, you know, what we have tangible experiences with, as opposed to, you know, having read about them in a book.
Absolutely. It sounds like it's going to be a lovely conversation on Sunday. Touchstones of Glaciers and Bears, Navigating a Changing Climate. Naomi Clauda and Mary Beth Holloman will be at the Juneau Public Library's The Valley Library at Sunday at 1 p.m. And, of course, you can go to marybethholloman.com for more information on Mary Beth. You can go to naomiclaudabooks.com for more information on Naomi and all of their various projects that they have coming up. What a pleasure it was to meet you both. Thank you so much for coming to Juneau and sharing this wonderful presentation with us.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having us on,
of course.
Boston. I really appreciate it.
Gwyneth Cheesh. Okay, this is Juneau Afternoon from KTOO. We'll be right back with Mudrooms.
Support from Hanson Gress. Seeking curious people who like technology, network engineering, and customer support. Opportunities for those who thrive on problem solving. Details at hansongress.com/careers.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizerwitz, and this is Climate Connections. Across the U.S., AI data centers, electric vehicles, and energy-intensive industries are driving a surge in the demand for electricity. But at the same time, some older power plants are retiring, and in many areas, the grid is struggling to keep up with growing energy needs.
The grid is in trouble. I don't think the general public knows how serious the situations that we're seeing.
Oliver Stover of the consulting firm Charles River Associates co-authored a report that shows that offshore wind can help. A single offshore wind turbine can power thousands of homes. And Stover says offshore wind can complement other power sources. In many areas, it reliably generates power at night, when solar panels do not. And in winter, when bad weather can disrupt natural gas plants.
Wind generation is materially stronger at night and much, much stronger in the winter. So this creates this really fantastic synergy with the resources that we already have on the grid now.
Despite federal pushback, developers have been building offshore wind farms near New England, New York, and Virginia, coastal areas with growing energy demands. So abundant ocean winds could soon help feed a hungry power grid with clean energy. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
Support for Juno Afternoon comes from Tongass Federal Credit Union, a member-owned financial cooperative offering checking and savings accounts, loans, and digital financial services. In Juno at 8585 Old Dairy Road in the K Plaza and at tongassfcu.com, federally insured by NCUA.
You're listening to KTOO's Tlingit Word of the Week. This week's word comes from Keishi Bessie Cooley, and the word this week is Jianwu.
Jianwu.
That means mountain goat. And here is a sentence. When boating on the Taku River, people always see mountain goats on the mountains. Let's hear it again. Mountain goat. Gunnish Cheesh to Hune Lance Twitchell, Gould Belt Heritage Foundation, and the University of Alaska Southeast for this audio.
Keishi Bessie Cooley is Kokhetan and a child of a Yenyedi man. She is from Daislin, Teslin, and grew up spending time in Teslin and around Teslin Lake. She earned a master's degree in Indigenous Languages and Linguistics from Simon Fraser University and interviewed many speakers for the Hashagun language series.
And tune in next week for another Tlingit Word of the Week from KTOO.
You are listening to Juno Afternoon from Studio 2K at KTOO, dedicated to Carolyn Hobbs Peterson. I'm your host, Boston Christopher. Ruh-roh! Doggone it. That's the theme for this month's Mud Rooms. And I think it's also closing out the season.
It is closing out the season.
Yeah. And here to share more about that and a look ahead is board member Taylor Beard. And this month's beneficiary, Southeast Alaska Food Bank, represented by Jeremiah Beadle. Gunnith Cheesh Wasiyati. How are you, Jeremiah?
I'm doing great. Thank you so much for having us here. And we're also very grateful to be the beneficiary of Mud Rooms this month. It's a wonderful opportunity, and we're grateful for both.
I love that. And Taylor Wasiyati, how are you? It's good to see you again.
Good to see you too, Boston.
Yeah. So let's remind everyone, it's Mud Rooms. It's Tuesday night, 7 o'clock.
7 o'clock, $7, 7 storytellers.
7 storytellers. And the lovely theme of Ruh-roh, doggone it.
Oh, yes. Because everybody has something go off-brand in their life where they're like, that did not go as I was expecting it to. And so we figured that was a good theme, and we have lots of good stories set up.
It's, you know, I have to tell you, Taylor, I know you've been asking me. I really should have done this month because, A, my mom and I, we used to watch Scooby-Doo together on the Saturdays. And B, my mother showed dogs for my entire life growing up. And so, like, just as you were talking about it, I'm like, this is such a natural fit for me. I don't know if my story would have been about something going wrong, but it definitely would have been about all of those things tied together. But maybe next year.
Technically, we might have a spot. If you do want to tell a story, Boston, I will happily take you.
I can't. Right. I'm hosting Poetry Out Loud on Monday, and I would not have time to do it. But okay. I want to.
I do know you want to. I do know you want to.
So, and is this the last Mud Rooms event for the year?
Yes. For the season, we had to skip one of our workshops because of the snow. But I think that we are planning to possibly do one during the summer. So it's not technically the last event, but it is the last storytelling event.
Okay. And of course, you can go to mudrooms.org for all information and various different things about it. But you're going to be now looking for next year's beneficiaries.
We are, yes.
And is that an application that people fill out?
Yes, there's the application will go live on Tuesday night on our mudrooms.org website. So if you were, are thinking about becoming a beneficiary and want to know more, I encourage you to come to the show and talk to us or look at the application. But yeah, we will be looking at applications for our beneficiaries next year in the next month or so.
And you're looking for like nonprofit organizations, things like that?
Needs to be a 501c3.
Okay, 501c3 and all of that. And then speaking of stories and board members and your website, you're looking for new board members as well.
We are looking for new board members. We're losing our wonderful board member, Jeff Smith.
Ruh-roh, doggone it.
I mean, he's been on the board forever. I totally get it. Yeah. But we also definitely need a board member who can help with the website stuff because strangely, none of us storytelling board members are savvy at website stuff. So, yeah, we definitely need a board member who's savvy with websites.
Who has some, who can do some social media and some board, some website.
Yes.
Okay, that I gotcha.
Crystal does our social media stuff, so we've got that. But yeah, website
so
would
really
be
about the
excellent.
Website. Okay. Mm-hmm. And how do people contact you about if they're interested in becoming a board member?
Just the contact us link on the mudrooms.org site, or talk to one of us at the show, or if you happen to see me in my colorful hair walking around, you know, please walk up to me and say, hey, I want to be a board member. Like there's lots of ways. So
just get in touch.
Yes, just please get in touch.
Absolutely. Okay, well, let's talk about this month's beneficiary, Southeast Alaska Food Bank. How's it going at the food bank right now, Jeremiah?
We are, I'd say we're doing well, but we're also trying to position for some, I won't say unexpected changes, because we've been given some warning with some of the bigger food assistance programs that are federally funded, and then also some programs that have some state backing. And it seems as if there is a strong drawback. And with that being the case, we're doing what we can to position ourselves to where we can step up to the plate and swing away when those issues do become more and more prevalent. However, we won't stand a chance. I'll just be honest. If the SNAP program, what was informally called food stamps, if it does dry up to the extent that they're anticipating here in our state, we don't have a solution for that. So we just, I think, to the tune of somewhere around $250 million comes into the state of Alaska, which then turns into twice as much when it stimulates spending in different local economies, especially in smaller places like Wrangell, Hoonah, Gustavus, up north, and Nome, and many of the other small villages throughout Alaska. Many of the smaller stores will, in all reality, they've come to the table and said, "Hey, we will have to close because without the SNAP program and that money coming in, we can't afford to be a store." And that's just from the folks that utilize those grocery stores to go shop for those, with those EBT cards. So there are going to be some big changes. Alaska, unfortunately, from what I've seen, hasn't positioned. We have so many other problems we're trying to address right now, and there are many, but we haven't positioned ourselves as strongly as we at the food bank would hope to address some of these coming changes on the federal level. And they're also passing a lot more of the cost from the federal level for these programs to the state level. And they are basing a lot of that cost on error rates and issues that are had inside the system of SNAP. And unfortunately, we are one of the worst offenders when it comes to error rates and issues. One of the big problems being we're just so remote. The folks that rely on it, they just can't show up and have an interview. They're all over Alaska.
We had some reporting here from Claire Strempel a couple years ago, and it continues. Like the SNAP benefits went through a lot of things. There was the backlog, and there was a lot of issues there, and people weren't getting their benefits for many, many months. And that also then caused issues.
And, at all the food banks pantries, we really did have to, we relied on every resource and leaned pretty hard on all that we had put into play. And luckily, we positioned ourselves to alleviate a lot of that stress.
And because you, as the food bank, obviously there's people that you serve, but you also work in partnership with a lot of other places and provide food and services to them, yeah?
We are the primary food provider to, I'd say, all of the food pantries that I can think of, or the great majority of them here in Southeast. So if you go to a food pantry somewhere, the chances that those are foods that they source through us is very high. So we are a food bank, and our primary role is to make sure all the food pantries and different programs that we support are as healthy as they can be as far as, you know, food stores are concerned. We also run our own food pantry out of necessity. It's very rare for food banks to run food pantries. We don't have much of a choice because Juneau is underserved when it comes to food pantries. So we still have our own pantries. But we do all sides of that. And then we have a shopping center type setup thing for folks that are part of the Juneau Mental Health Alliance. You know, for folks that rely on JAMI, they come through, they're able to shop with us. I think we have it set up for about £22 per week for them to come in and actually go through, look at all the items that we have provided for them. We're kind of like a mini grocery store in there that they can then shop for different items, have a say in what they're going to eat, and that way things aren't just going to go to waste. And we do that for Housing First as well, and we provide a great majority of the food that they serve over at the Glory Hall as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And what's the website for people if they want to check out the Southeast Alaska Food Bank?
I think it's just as simple as that, southeastalaskafoodbank.org, I believe is what it is. Or if you just search.
Put it in
search.
Your favorite search engine.
Yeah. We'll pop up. We're antiquated on our website. So as
you need another board member over there as well.
So we are in the process of trying to draw all that stuff up. We have the warehouse now. We have a very strong staff. We're staffed to about twice of what we may have been, just a couple years ago. And we're pulling on new programs and trying to be as powerful as we can be for Southeast Alaska and to be a true food bank. Now that we have our warehouse, we are an honest food bank. We don't run out of food by the end of the week and ask member agencies to, go to other resources for food. At this point, we can supply that lion's share and happily do so with stores in excess for the next week.
The great beneficiary for Mudrooms to happen. So back to Mudrooms on Tuesday night, 7 o'clock. That's March 10th, I believe. And who do we have on the lineup for stories?
So far we have Joe Meehan, Kim Parmer, Stacey Oliver, Henny Barnes, Tony Newman, and Bryce Hiles.
Awesome. Okay, so they'll be telling, the structure is they get 7 minutes, no notes, No notes. They get somebody to work with, right?
Yes.
We're always looking for more storytellers, right? So we always want more storytellers in there. But you get help.
You get help. Yes. Yeah. If you want help, you get help.
Yeah.
We usually have a rehearsal, like we had the rehearsal last night, and so we ask them to run through their story once with us because, you know your story, but you don't necessarily, the people you're telling it to don't know all the details. So it's like you run through it once and it's like, hey, I have a question about what happened here. This isn't obvious. And so they're able to kind of suss through the semantics of their stories to make it better. So
yeah, absolutely.
We do coach and do all of that stuff. So.
And this is at the Konekiti Northern Light Church on Tuesday night, right?
Mm-hmm.
I think we forgot to mention that.
Konekiti.
Where it's at. Yeah. And it's only $7.
It's only $7.
And cash.
You can always give more than $7 if you would like.
Right. We would certainly appreciate it.
It is a $7 donation. We encourage you to give more. It's going to a great cause.
I love that. And if you are looking to be a storyteller or potentially a board member or want to learn more about Mudrooms and how it works or maybe take a workshop, be on the lookout for workshop that might be happening this summer. Do you all have like a social media too? Are you on like
we
Insta
do. We
and all
have
that?
We have an Instagram account. I think it is Juneau Mudrooms.
Okay.
At Juneau Mudrooms. I want to say
probably.
I should know this.
In there.
I should know this.
Yeah. And then are you on Facebook as well?
I believe we are also on Facebook.
Okay, that's cool. So. And then you can find those links to your social medias at the website, I believe, mudrooms.org. And the other thing that I always thought was really cool about Mudrooms is that if you want inspiration on the website, whoever did it, if it was Jeff or whoever did it before, every single story is on the website. So you can go back and listen to Mudrooms from 4 years ago, 5 years ago, and get some inspiration. You can see what those themes were, how people incorporated them.
You can look up your friends, see if they told stories.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Because do you have a number? I know I'm putting you on the spot here. Do you have a number of how many storytellers you've had over the years?
No. It's season 14, so I mean,
14, wow. Yeah, and so, I know there's been some repeats, but really it's like 6 to 8 episodes every season, right? Plus 7 people. That's like 56.
I can't math today.
You've had probably over 500, I bet.
Yes, probably.
I bet you've probably had over 500.
It's an extensive list.
Yeah, that's pretty awesome. And all those are available on the website. Mm-hmm. So again.
784.
Whoa, okay.
By that math, yeah. 784.
Yeah, wow, that's amazing. Mudrooms.org is the website for that. It's Tuesday night. Rut Road, doggone it, is the theme. It's $7, 7 storytellers, and all for a good cause for the Southeast Alaska Food Bank. Jeremiah Beadle, Taylor Beard, Gunnath Cheesh for being here and telling us all about it. I really appreciate it.
Yeah. Gunnath Cheesh for having us. Yeah.
Thank you so much.
All right.
That will do it for today's Juno Afternoon. On tomorrow's we don't have a show tomorrow. Juno Afternoon airs Wednesday through Friday at 3 p.m. right here on KTOO 104.3 and KAUK, Juno Auk Bay 91.7. You can find the show online at ktoo.org/JunoAfternoon. You can also find live stream archives on KTOO's YouTube page. Our theme music is by Indian Agent, and programming support comes from listeners and viewers like you, plus Country Financial, Heritage Coffee, Roasting Company, Hanson Gress, and Tongass Federal Credit Union. Have a good weekend. Gunnath Cheesh.